Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Devil or angel, I can't make up my mind. Which one you are, I'd like to wake up and find.
This is the Savage Nation.
Devil or angel, whichever you are.
We're going to hear the quizzling Maya Bloomberg in a way that only you can describe your blood, your state of mind after you hear this man. There's almost no words for Bloomberg the prostitute other than Bloomberg the prostitute. When you listen to him, it's not that he had a Ramadan dinner. They all do that. That I understand. But the way, the obsequious nature in which Bloomberg, a man of Jewish heritage, if not of faith, that a man of Jewish heritage who is an arch-liberal, who is more wed, in my opinion, to the religion of liberalism than to the religion of his fathers, how he bends over backwards in such an obsequious manner to tell you what a great man he is for hosting a Ramadan dinner at Gracie Mansion. Then he lectures you about diversity. Then he says it's just like St. Patrick's Day or Harlem Week, without even understanding that this unto itself is absurd. And I'll play that for you. And then I'm going to play for you what Bloomberg and company have provoked inside New York City. You will hear the sound of an 82-year-old Holocaust survivor being verbally abused by a Victory Mosque supporter. So let us begin with Maya Bloomberg on clip 22.
Well, good evening and Ramadan Kareem. And I want to welcome everyone to our annual Ramadan Iftar at Gracie Mansion. We call this the People's House because it belongs to all 8.4 million New Yorkers who call this city home. And people of
every
race.
Right there. What do you mean it belongs to all the people? The People's House? Are you going to invite people who run criminal gangs in there too because it's their house? This is insanity. This is insanity, but listen to the rest of this. It gets worse.
That diversity here in this house with gatherings just like this one.
Like this one, boys and girls.
Whether it's marking St. Patrick's Day or Harlem Week or any other occasion, these gatherings are always a powerful reminder of what makes our city so strong and our country so great.
So this is a liberal psychopath whose religion is diversity and liberalism, who compares building a Victory Mosque at Ground Zero to celebrating St. Patrick's Day in Gracie Mansion, and doesn't even understand the absurdity of what he just said. But it gets worse in a minute. Go on to the next one in clip 23.
Nation of immigrants. And I think it's fair to say no place opens its doors more widely to the world than New York City.
Right, look at the doors of the World Trade Center, how wide you open them.
And it's fair to say no place offers its residents more opportunity to pursue their dreams than New York City.
Flying planes into the World Trade Center. What a dream that was.
Of freedom.
And beacon of the World Trade Center. What a beacon that was.
Those freedoms more fervently or has been attacked for those freedoms more ferociously than New York City. In recent weeks, a debate has arisen that I
Do you hear the sing-songy voice like you're a bunch of idiots in the fifth grade? Do you hear this? Does he think that you're the big idiot because you're not a billionaire like him, a brawny big billionaire like him? It's sickening. I don't think I want to play anymore because soon I'm going to start to get angry and I don't like getting angry. I'm listening to a man who was so out of touch with reality that the only explanation would be medical. The only explanation for Bloomberg's adherence to liberalism to this extent of digging his high heels in like this is medical. And I'm not a doctor of that. I'm not a psychiatrist, but only a doctor could tell us the exact medical condition and what would describe Bloomberg here. Look, I know you worry about what's going on in Afghanistan, what's going on in the Gulf, and what's going on in the White House. But with all of that, you shouldn't have to worry about your computer on top of everything else. So go visit my advertisers at Carbonite.com. They'll back up all your important files so they're safe no matter what happens. Use my offer code SAVAGE, and you're going to get 2 months free with your subscription. That's Carbonite.com, offer code SAVAGE. A conflict over the building of a mosque on the ashes of the victims of 9/11. And strangely enough, we have a mayor who's in favor of building a mosque on the ashes of 9/11, when most of the people of New York, except the radical left, want the mosque built. And this is even odder now. The division within the liberal community is growing. Here is the Democrat New York State Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, a very controversial man, a very liberal, a Democrat through and through, who calls for the relocation of the Ground Zero Mosque for the sake of peace.
I, along with the governor, believe very firmly in our Constitution guarantees us the right to freedom of religion, and that includes, obviously, the right to build houses of worship. However, I do believe, especially this center, as it's advertised, is supposed to bring people together, supposed to be a place that everybody can come to. And in view of that, I think the sponsors should take into very serious consideration the kind of turmoil that's been created and look to compromise the issues before them and find a suitable place that doesn't create the kind of controversy it does.
So now here's a man who's extremely controversial, attacked every day and surrounded by controversy. He's a liberal Democrat through and through, and he comes out calling for the relocation of Ground Zero Mosque for the sake of peace. He says that the sponsor should take into serious consideration the turmoil that's been created and look for compromise. Now, that's the key word, compromise. But something you have to understand is that the fanatics behind this mosque are uncompromising in their fanaticism. That's something you must understand. The fanatics behind this mosque at that place, the old Burlington Coat Factory, are adamant in their uncompromising views. They don't want compromise, don't you understand? They want conflict, not compromise. Can't you figure that out yet?
Savage.
We will keep families in their homes, we'll create new jobs, and we'll allow our businesses to grow without Washington interference. We will secure our borders, defend our nation, and bring our troops home from Afghanistan with honor and victory.
How in the world they can do it? See, this is why I've never been a politician. People said, you know, you should be a politician. You should run for office. You should be this, you should be that. I could never be a politician. I'm too plain spoken. I speak the truth. How can you believe McCain? Let's start with anything he says. When McCain opens his mouth, you know he's lying. But how can you believe a man who, after a victory that he spent $20 million to defeat a radio talk show, so there's a real conservative, he gets up there and he just gives a speech like suddenly it's 1966. Will keep people in their homes? What is he going to do, pay off their mortgages? So again, he's in favor of expanding government. We're going to create new jobs. What kind of jobs? Census Bureau jobs? And then he comes with the same shibboleth that you've learned to hear from the fake Republican. Allow businesses to grow without Washington interference. He is Washington. Secure our borders? Did he say anything about deporting illegal aliens? Did he say anything about stopping amnesty for illegals? No, he's going to do it again. You in Arizona got just what you deserve. You got just what you deserve because he's going to do it again. He is going to join Obama the same way he joined Bush in seeking amnesty for illegal aliens. So there it is. Him and Cindy can now take their victory trip to Tibet and see how their Buick dealership is going. Now, people say to me, I'm off the record now. I mean, on the record. I'm on the radio show talking to so many people, and I speak with you as though we're in a room together. People are worried. I run into people, otherwise intelligent people. Some are very successful, some modest, whatever. And they say to me, what's going on? Is Obama a traitor? Why in the heck is he spending so much emphasis on the mosques and on Muslims? Why is he permitting the State Department to prosecute Sheriff Joe in Arizona? Why is he catering to the most violent extremists in Mexico and in the Islamic world? Is he a traitor? They ask me that. I just shake my head. I don't even want to answer them. And then they say to me, what's going to happen? How is this going to end? The currency is worthless, they say to me. They all know. Everyone, look, I'm reaching in my right pocket. I'm taking out a stack of 20s and 10s, whatever was in my pocket. Ones, right? I never carry a lot of money. I like cash. I grew up on a cash guy. So I have the credit card. To me, it still looks like a $20 bill. Most people look at it, they say it's a green piece of paper. It has no value whatsoever. So therefore, what's our currency worth? It's based on faith. Then you have a government that says, here's our faith, and it will show you what the faith we have. We're going to print as much of it as we need to continue the Ponzi scheme. Although the Ponzi scheme is what broke the economy, we're going to create another one by printing money. It has no basis in value. It's not backed by gold since Nixon. It's not backed on anything anymore. So people are worried, what will happen to you? What's going to happen? And they say, do you think we could wind up like in Germany in the Weimar Republic, where a person needed a wheelbarrow pushing a wheelbarrow full of German marks, to buy a loaf of bread? Took hundreds of thousands of German marks to buy a loaf of bread because the currency had become that worthless. Or I remember when I was young and I went to Italy, how almost comedic it looked to me when I saw Italian currency, printed currency, in larger sizes. So 1,000 liras was a smaller note than 10,000 liras, which was smaller than 100,000 liras. Leave it to the Italians. In other words, the size of the paper indicated the value of the dollar, of the lira at that time, which I thought was funny. I mean, I didn't understand it until eventually the largest bill you carry was like a lettuce, like a roll of lettuce in your pocket. So you say, well, is that what they're going to do? Well, you look at the franc. Why do you think the French, I say to myself and say to people who talk to me for my opinion, asking my opinion, I'm giving you the plain truth. My opinion is all you're going to get out of me on this radio show. I'm not running for office. I have no end in sight. I mean, I have no end. I don't want anything from you. I don't want anything from you. I'm only giving you one man's opinion. So here it is. Here's the opinion. Tell me about the French franc. Well, it turns out that, for example, there's a thing called a franc and a new franc, and an old franc and a new franc. What's a new franc? The time when I first went to France, when I was very young, 18, 19, I don't remember when, big trip to Europe, you know, writer, this and that, cafes, cigarettes, Galoisie, motor scooter, leotards, black leotards, girls, wine, women's song, blah, blah, blah. The franc had been revalued at some point after World War II. They created what was known as a new franc because they couldn't support the government, couldn't support itself based on the old franc. So they made every franc all of a sudden was worth 10 francs. Could that happen here? Could we wake up and find out that Greenspan so wrecked the economy? And the other fellow at the SEC, whose name you have forgotten, who has disappeared like into the woodwork, or Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, could it be that we'll wake up one day and the $20 bill that I have in my pocket, which I'll take out right now, this $20 bill will suddenly become the equivalent of a $2 bill? Will that become the equivalent of 20 old francs? And then suddenly the government will churn out a new bill that says 20 new francs, 20 new dollars. It won't have a picture of Jackson on it. It'll have a picture of Reverend High Jackson on it. And then maybe the $10 bill will have Reverend Sharpton or maybe an imam on it. Maybe Imam Ralph would be on it instead of Hamilton. It'll be 10 old dollars and it'll be the 10 new dollars. This 10 old dollars becomes worth a dollar. Hey, that's a good way to balance the economy if you're Alan Greenspan and your old lady works for MSNBC. What do you care? Doesn't matter to you. You have so much money. What does it matter whether it's old dollars or new dollars? Presto. So it has been done before. Don't think it can't happen here. It could happen here. And under Pinocchio, it's liable to happen here. Pinocchio's enjoying himself eating lobster, and Mrs. Pinocchio's guzzling champagne and eating ice cream, like Marie Antoinette, someone wrote, and comes back and goes to the vegetable garden and tells you to eat light off the earth and children are too fat, and then goes in the kitchen for the cherry vanilla. He tells you to tighten your belt, and he goes and rents a $50,000 a week house, tells you to tighten your belt. And America right now is very, very upset with this administration. So what does it matter to him if his money men say, you know what, make the $20 bill, make a new $20 bill. We're going to print the new $20 bill, and it'll be called 20 new dollars. And how that works is you go into a store, and you pull out one that I have in my pocket, a Jackson, And it's no longer a $20 bill, it's a $20 bill, which is now worth the equivalent of $2. And you have to have a $20 bill for it to be worth $20. Can't happen here. It has happened there. And since it's happened there, why can't it happen here, I ask myself. So that's one thing I say to people. Then they say to me, well, what about throwing the bums out in November? I said, I doubt it. I doubt the Democrats are going to be thrown out the way all of the idiots in the media predict. Wow, how could you say that? Everyone knows they're corrupt and un-American. How could you say that? I said, answer, war. What do you mean war? They asked me. I said, well, study history. Every country, including our own, that's gotten into trouble financially has gone to war.
Money! Get away. Get a good job before paying your okay.
I've created a digital a nation on the radio. It's like, what do you call it? Digital? Would you say it's a digital? Well, we're not digital yet. All the radio stations are not digital. Are they all digital yet, Beowulf? I don't even know. No, they're still. I've created an analog universe. I have an analog community that I've created called the Savage Nation. And I don't expect people to suddenly get together like in the old days and, you know, one for all and all for one. It's not that way. You know, I've had very, very good fortune with radio as a result of my hard work and my talent. And my unwillingness to quit and my unwillingness to compromise. So I've done very well. So you got to take the... Stop it, Teddy. You got to take the bad with the good. Things happen. And that's all there is to it. Life is not smooth. Play some music for a minute.
One, two, three. Hey. Look at Mr. Lee. Three, four, five. Hey. Look at him jump.
What do you expect, a smooth run? I mean, who has a life like that? So you have one thing, so something else happens. Do you take the guy who you think is at the top of the world? I don't care who it is. Teddy, cut it out or you're going to get fired. You're supposed to be the mascot. Now you're taking over the radio station. This is the Savage Nation.
My heart is aching.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Today's show is called Black Dog, Black Man. And here's how it works. Here's how it works. And it's a hard story to tell. It's a hard story to start. But once I get into the story, it's going to be very easy to tell. I don't have a way to begin this story other than to tell you I was on my bicycle before the show in one of my moods. I go in and out of moods. And grousing about, I just read that there was a Russian in New York who bought a $150 million apartment, so I started to get mad. Grousing about that, saying, I don't understand this world I'm living. And this guy has enough money to buy another $150 million apartment. Well, something's wrong with the picture here. So I said, look, I have a choice right now. I could sit here getting angry, or I get on my bicycle and take a 10-minute ride, because I remember that many years ago, 20 years ago, I read a couple of self-help books. And one of them said that in the few minutes that you're sitting there grousing about how bad things are, you can send a letter, make a phone call, run around the block. And you know what? It helped me then, and it helps me now. So I got on the bike, and I went down to a kind of isolated area where they're building some new houses by the water, because I love to watch houses under construction. It's very optimistic to see the wood and the contractors and the this and the that. And I'm out by the point, and I'm coming back, and I see this big, black, Great Dane off a leash. Now, I happen to be afraid of black dogs. I mean, big black dogs. In fact, big white dogs. In fact, big dogs generally frighten me because I was bitten when I was young, right down to the bone, and had to be hospitalized. So I have a real respect for dogs. So I said, now I got to be very careful as I go by this Great Dane. I don't know whose it is. If I let out anger inside of me, the dog's going to feel it. If I let out fear, the dog's going to fear it. So I said, just be cool and go. Don't go too fast. Don't go. So I go by, the dog doesn't bother me. I said, thank God for that. Then I come upon a guy who's got a truck, who's doing auto detailing. And he's a big black guy. I've seen him once in a while. Huge, I mean like a football size guy. And he comes out of the truck and he says to me, you're looking good. And I said, what? He says, you lose some weight? And we start to talk. I didn't know the guy. I've seen him around, but he thought he knew me. He said he knew me, not thought, he knew me. for a number of years. He's been around this county doing cars. He's a great guy. I'm going to tell you the story now, where it goes. So one thing leads to another, and he says to me, you remind me of another radio guy I knew. He says, this guy was as smooth as can be. He could walk the ghetto, and he could walk the White House. So I said, you know, let me tell you something. I said, David, I grew up in New York City, and I had to learn how to swim with all kinds of fish. New York City was a very big fish tank, and if you didn't learn how to swim the right way, they'd tear your fins off. And he laughed. He says, well, they wouldn't just tear your fins off. He says, they'd eat you for breakfast. And we started to talk. Now, he grew up in a black ghetto here in Marin County. There is one, and it was called Marin City. It's an interesting story unto itself. The housing was built by the magnate, Kaiser. When they were building Liberty ships in World War II, they needed to bring in workers, and they didn't bring them in from Mexico. They brought workers in from the South, and they were largely black people, and they built housing for them. And you may not know it, but many of the ship workers, you know about Rosie the Riveter, of course, but you didn't know that most of the Liberty ships were built by black people, particularly out here in Sausalito at the Kaiser shipyards. So the housing was built nearby, and it's become basically, largely a black community. And naturally, the way things have evolved in our society, and blame whoever you want, it hasn't been a picnic for the people living in there. So we were walking around, and we were just standing there talking about the dog and the this and the that. So I said, well, how did you come through that place and come out the way you are? You see, he's a pastor. In addition to running a service that, you know, polishes cars, he happens to be a minister. His name is Pastor David Hall. And I'm going to tell you more about that in a few minutes and where this went, and how that went there, and how positive this man was. And we were laughing. He says, you know, I know people around here, very rich people. He says, their children can't play with anybody. I said, why? He says, well, I told him the reason your kid can't play with anyone is because you've given them everything. They got all these toys. They sit in the house and they play electronic toys. They don't know how to play with anybody. I said, isn't that a shame? And I told him that I'm a people person, that I basically am not really a loner. I don't really like to be alone. But I figured if I got out on the bike, I said, I'd run into somebody to talk to. And I said, sure enough, this was like hitting, you know, the triple lottery for me in terms of the kind of person I am. It's like all four cherries came up on that big, slot machine in the sky of humanity. And this goes back to what I told you a story years ago about me and Brother Billy down in Harlem when I was a kid. But that's a whole separate story. But this is going to lead somewhere else. So we're talking and this and that. We look up a hill where they're building the houses above where he's polishing the cars. And he says, when I was a kid, he said, you know what we used to do for fun? I said, what? He said, we'd slide down the hill on like linoleum. I said, I can't believe it. I said, we did the same thing. I said, I lived in a tenement on a block called Longfellow Avenue in the Bronx. And above me was a hill called Bryan Avenue. Between us was a big empty woodlot that had a huge hill on it that was denuded of foliage. And we'd slide down it on oil cloth, you know, old linoleum. And I said, well, we'd also play war. He said, how'd that work? I said, well, we'd take the garbage can covers. We'd put them in our hands, and there'd be like a gang of us. I'm talking kids 5, 6, 7 years old. No one had guns or knives. And the game was to run up the hill against the other street as they were raining ash down upon us. And like Gladiator, bounce, bounce, bing, bing. And I said, my head would get split open 100 times in these things. I always had a knack. I don't know where the ash guys, you know what the ash is from? He said, no. I said, well, in those days, I said, they had garbage that they would burn in incinerators. And the leftover of that burn was like a volcanic ash. You know, thank God they don't do it anymore. And I said, these kids would get the ash out of the incinerator and rain it down upon us, and you'd have to fend it off. You can go home, you can get killed. So I said, many a time I'd come home with my head bleeding, with blood running down my head. And I'd come home, my mother would faint before I got through the door. She was like a panic case. She'd go, oh, my God, and she'd fall on the floor basically screaming and yelling, I'm bleeding, and she's doing nothing. But I said, next door, I had an aunt who was like stoic, like Russian aunt. Nothing fazed this woman. She'd look at me with the sober face, get out the peroxide and bandage it up, and that was it. So he lit up, David did, and he says, when are you going to write that book? I was like, bung. I said, what? He said, when are you going to write that book? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, all those stories of your youth, he says, those are great stories. Well, we talked about so many different things. So he went back to when he was poor, and he said, I got to tell you, so I grew up on welfare. He says, my father left us when I was five. He says, I'm one of six children. And he says, yeah, I ate the government cheese, he says with a big smile. He says, yeah, I grew up on the government cheese. And he says, I'd say to my mother, he says, Mom, if there's a God, why am I hungry? Now I said, oh, God, what a question. I said, kids are so smart. I said, they're brilliant. And he said, my mother told me, never be bitter, never be angry, always have faith. Now, this is the most important part of the story, is the faith that this man had. He didn't turn to bitterness. He didn't turn to anger. He didn't hate Whitey. He didn't hate America. He just did what he did, and he did it, and he did it, and he did it. And you know what? He's the richest man I've met in recent years. He is the wealthiest man I have ever met in the last 10 years. And I've met people with a lot of money. And I said, you know, you remind me of the story that Tolstoy wrote, The Kingdom of God is Within. I said, because you do emanate the goodness. He said, well, Michael, if you don't give anything back, you're going to be empty inside. And this man lives to give, because he said in giving he gets love. Now, if this is not the epitome of what the Christian religion today is all about, I'd like to know what is. And so I guess the moral of the story is that the humanity in the other man can never be known until you have a contact with the other man. And, oh, I remember what a particular story, before I go to the next spot, got to him. I said, let me tell you a story. My dad owned a little store, and he had started on the streets of New York with a push cart. He came from the gutter. He was an immigrant with nothing, and he never really became a wealthy man. I said, but he had a little stall inside a store, and he sold first the used things, then he sold some antique things, and he always made a living. We had a house and always food on the table. And I said, well, one day, I said, it was all white people in there. I said, never did you see anyone but white people in that market. Now, remember who I'm talking to now. I'm talking to a stranger who happens to be a black man, who happens to be, like, you talk about fullback football team, huge man. And we're just looking at each other and talking. So I said, it's an all-white store. In comes a black man, well-dressed. And I said, he says to my dad, how much is that? My father says, oh, a certain amount of money. How much is that? He's pointing at different statues. All right, how much is that? How much? He says, I'll take them all. So now the man leaves, writes him a check, and my father pulls me over, and he says, I want to tell you something, Michael. He says, listen to what just happened in this store, because it's a lesson you're going to learn for the rest of your life. I said, what's that? He says, never judge a man by the color of his skin. He said, you never know who the man is, you never know what the man is, and you never know what that man's all about until you have an interaction with him. So when I told it to a pastor, Pastor Hall, he says, that is a beautiful story. He says, you've got to tell that story. And so I've just told that story.
Savage.
I want to talk a little bit about noise. I saw an article about people who got their dream apartment in Manhattan, and then they couldn't sleep because of the noise. It said, as soon as the moving crew left, we sat back to enjoy our new digs. I just love the word digs. It makes me it's such a cheap English word, digs. I heard that like 40 years ago. You ever hear words that make you cringe? I knew people who affected it. The guy who first used the word digs lived in Jackson Heights, Queens. His father was a chiropractor. He had like a rack. He was like an actual doctor. Like a chiropodist or something. I don't know what he was. He stretched people on racks. So this kid always wanted to be English. And although he wasn't English, he wasn't really even white. He passed for white. But he affected being an Englishman the rest of his life. He wore the Brooks Brothers suit. And he used words like digs. He's thin, good-looking kid. And he married a very wealthy girl whose father owned a bank. He did very well for himself. But the point is, when he first used the word digs, you know what I mean? So anyway, they move into the digs here. You can see what kind of show it's going to be today. And that's when another of its attributes sank in. It was noisier in our living room than it was on the street, she writes. Honks and sirens ricocheted around us from every direction and at every time of the day and night. Garbage trucks crashed down the street like steel avalanches. Drivers followed with hands attached to horns. Then came more impatient drivers, sirens, car alarms, and more horns. And so they then try to stop the noise. It doesn't work. They went crazy. And so in search of peace and quiet, they went to look for a padded room that they could put inside their bedroom, an isolation chamber, noise-deadening curtains, and a sleeping box. In other words, like a coffin. What they had to do to get rid of the jackhammers were to use an old air conditioner. I use that once in a while. It blacks everything out. The older air conditioners are the best. Don't get a new air conditioner. Try to find an old one from an old woman. Just put them on, not on air conditioning. You put them on, you know, vent. Now, I have a question for you. Does noise bother you? What is your worst source of noise and how do you handle it? Is it a dog? It is a neighbor with drums? Is it a basketball hoop in the driveway? Is it someone? I mean, what is it? Kenai, Alaska. Linda, you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Okay, we built a beautiful house on a piece of property a couple of years ago. 1 year later, our neighbors moved in with about 15 sled dogs, and they get going about 3 a.m. every night.
What, howling?
Oh, howling and barking, yeah.
It's heartbreaking. See, this is the problem, Linda, why I don't seek anything anymore in life. There is no perfection on planet Earth. There is no peace. There is no peace. There's no perfection anywhere, I've discovered. I've become almost like a Zen monk in not seeking. I have relative calm in my life and relative peace. Don't get me wrong. But the point I'm making is the minute you start seeking perfection, you don't find perfection. You know that. And the terrible tragedy here is that you went to the outer limits. You went to Alaska. You built. How many acres are you on?
About 5.
And you still can't find peace up there. Wait a minute. Have you asked them about the dogs howling?
Well, when they first moved in, they said, if the dogs are barking, keeping you awake, let us know. So we did. And they said, they're not barking. They're howling.
Ah. That's like a liberal answer to every question. First, they act like they're nice. And then when you ask them something, they give you a double talk. So we can do anything you want today on the Savage Nation. We can talk about noise, which noise bothers you the most, and how do you deal with it. I've been running from noise virtually my entire life. If you ask me why I originally left New York a long time ago, it was over noise and pollution. So then I go to Hawaii originally, and what's there? Noise and pollution. And I moved to California to a valley. What did I find? Noise and pollution. No matter where I move, it's noise and pollution. Now we had a caller who lives in Alaska. They have a beautiful home they built. What do they have? Sled dogs, 3 in the morning, howling. So what are you going to do with them in a story like that? What you got to do is you realize that the Buddhist monks had it right, is that you basically have to go back into the maelstrom in order to get away from it. Only by facing the maelstrom can you avoid the maelstrom. It's an amazing kind of Tai Chi about life, is that the more you seek to avoid something, the more it pursues you and you pursue it. And that's why I originally took my son to the lion cage. You don't know about that. No, because I think I've told the story. I had met a martial artist in Hawaii 20, 30 years ago. And no, 20 years. I don't remember. And he was a very, very interesting guy. And he said his master made them go in front of the lion cage in the Honolulu Zoo and stand there until the lion's roar, you know, behind the bars didn't scare them. I said, wow, that's amazing. So I went to the lion's cage and roared and I got scared. I mean, that roar cuts through you. You ever hear lions roar? The resonance of a lion is fabulous. And I taught my son, never, ever let a man's screams or yells at you intimidate you. It's only an attempt to get you to do what he wants. So, you know, most people will just scream and yell, and particularly in business, they're not going to hurt you, at least in verbally, you know. So don't be intimidated by people screaming and yelling at you. We did the lion thing. The Lion King. The Lion King.
In the jungle.
My uncle owned a deli, a little deli on 14th Street. He owned it for a short period of time. I was thrilled that I finally had someone in the food business. It was such a kick as a little kid to go into the, like your uncle owns a deli. It's like you get embarrassed as a little kid. Like you see, like before he had no apron on and he wasn't behind the counter. He was like a regular person. Then all of a sudden he's like an official as a kid. Kids see the world a different way. There's my uncle behind the counter. To you, if that guy, your uncle behind the counter with a white apron on, like he's like a cop or a teacher or like an authority because he can cut ham on a machine. Somehow he's part of the government if he's a kid. Your kids have a weird view of the world. Man, do we love going in there and getting like provisions. You know, when a relative would open a business, the way it was done, all the other family members would go in the first day and buy a lot of stuff for cash. No one put it on credit and stiffed them. Today you go in and put it on credit and stiff the relative. Yeah, buy $1,000, $10,000, and then they give them a stiff job. That's the relatives today. Those days you went and you put hard cash down. They put the dollar bill. Remember the good dollar bill? The first dollar they put on? It's a different world. The deli men had hairy, like hairy thing. I don't know how they grow hair on the outside of their hands. Men don't even have hair like that anymore. The hair is diminished from political correctness on men. Like I have a hairy chest and a hairy back. It comes out of the ears and nose. But they had hair that grew like on the outside of the hand, like opposite the palm, the back of your hand. It was like scary, like ape men. Underneath white shirts, like hair came out. There's no men around like that, unless they're from Iraq or something. I don't know where they come from, guys like that. That's how you know you're getting, like, older. Like, guys, like, they can get away with murder in their 20s. They still think they're kids. Yeah, I'm still young. I'm never going to die. Don't worry about it. I go, party all night. 30, like, the belly starts to, no matter what you do, abs, no such thing. Always a roll. First gray hairs, pluck them out. Here they come again. That's it. And that the 30s are very hard. You ask any guy, those are the toughest years on earth. 40 is nothing already. You know you're going to get flabby and die. 50, you look forward to being flabby and dying. At 60, you can't wait to... No, that's the way it works. The 30s are terrible because you're still trying to hold on to youth. But when the hair starts coming out of your ears, ooh. And you got to get one of those close mirrors, you really start to look ugly. I'm like an ape man. And the nostril hairs, ooh. Why did nature devise that? You say, okay, to keep flies and flying things out of your nasal passages and your ears. So I can dig that. But why not in children? They're vulnerable. Why don't children have hair in their ears? Or hair in their nostrils at 10? You ever see an infant in the... An infant laying on a blanket like at a picnic? I mean, insects could fly into their nose. Why don't they have nose hair? There's like certain curses that nature waits for you after a certain age. All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you excessive nostril hair and excessive ear hair so that you look particularly ugly as you're fading. Not you're going to get more beautiful and I'm going to cut away the hair. No, we're going to give you, you're going to lose the hair on your head where you need it. We're going to put it in your nose and your ears where you don't need it. You needed the nose hair and the ear hair when you were 20 and running around and chasing the women around on the lawns. What do you need it at 50 for? What do you need nose and ear hair? You need the hair on the head. They don't give it to you. It falls out. Falls out of your head and it winds up in your nose. I don't understand life. There's some, like, twisted gene here. Or God is, like, playing games with us toward the end.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Is the Savage Nation. We're talking about Pelosi's poison, where she said that anyone who opposes the Ground Zero Mosque should be investigated. And so Pelosi, who has come up from the swamp of San Francisco, is now attempting to drag the First Amendment into that swamp. And all of this goes on as the Obamas take the sixth holiday of the year at the Massachusetts island known as Martha's Vineyard, the playground of the American banking system. Those in the investment community are well known to fly their private jets to Martha's Vineyard and circulate with each other so they can plan their next vintage of economic woe for the average American. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I would also like to direct you to the website, of course, because I'm very proud of my book, Trickle Up Poverty, in that it's not out yet. It's already number 6 on the political book list. Stopping Obama's Attack on Our Borders, Economy, and Security. I think it's a great book. And I want to say something that's very important because the point's not been made by anyone yet. People think that Obama is taking from the rich to give to the poor. This is the deceit. I wrote this book to prove definitively that, like all Marxists, he's taking from the middle class to give to the rich. This is something that needs to be understood. If you're to prevent another communist revolution from occurring on the globe. What you don't understand is this. Why would a guy like George Soros go out of his way to try to elect a man like Obama? Is it because George Soros wants more people to thrive in America, more people to thrive within the middle class of America? No, the opposite. A guy like George Soros, who has made countless billions of dollars in his lifetime, sometimes by trying to destroy the currency of England, another time trying to destroy the currency of Malaysia, trading money, whatever he has to do to make his billions, and then he funds radical left-wing causes. Why? Because people who meet on Martha's Vineyard don't like the middle class. People who meet on Martha's Vineyard, who elected their puppet Obama, in fact, want to destroy the middle class in order to continue to profit themselves. Now you say, well, why would they want to do that? In my opinion, as I explain in Trickle Up Poverty, why do I say Obama has targeted the middle class? Because in a Marxist society, it's a two-class, Marxist societies are two-class societies. The ruling elite, the Politburo is part of the ruling elite, and then, of course, there's the peasant, the peon, the nothing. And so there's a very small or non-existent middle class in true Marxist societies. America has been known, if known for anything, for its very large middle class. It's what defined us as a nation. And so now we see the first president in American history whose every measure has targeted the American middle class, whether it be economic measures or health measures or military measures or cultural measures. They're all targeting the average guy and doll in the middle class. The Ground Zero Mosque, you may say, what does it have to do with it? It's part of the same program. If it affronts the middle class's Christian beliefs, good. That's what we want. We're left-wingers, and we want to get in their face. We want to see more mosques in America. We want to see the churches hollowed out and turned into other things. We want to see America lose its cultural identity. That's what a Marxist does. That's what Obamanomics has done. That's what Obama's doing. And that's why I say trickle-up poverty is more than about the economy. It's about his attack on every level of our society, our borders. Why would he attack Sheriff Joe in Arizona instead of attacking the drug cartels? Why would he go to war with the people of Arizona instead of going to war with the government of Mexico? Because he wants America to be weakened and to melt down, stopping Obama's attack on our borders, economy, and security. Okay, Trickle Up Poverty, my new book, is your best defense against the Obamanomics that are dragging the middle class and everyone else into a Marxist socialist death spiral. Okay, pre-order it now on Amazon.com. More as the time evolves. The book is going to be a monster hit. I don't need you to tell me that. And I didn't write it to make a fortune. I wrote it, truthfully, to interfere with the American election. That's right. I want to interfere with the plans that Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod have for reelecting Obama in 2012 and making sure that the Democrats retain their seats in November. That's right. The book is targeted directly at them. Look, I could say Obama's the most inept president in history and could say it's the most corrupt administration in history, and you'd agree with me. Therefore, we're going to play rock and roll. I'm going through almost a little bit of a mental divorce from him. He's starting to get to me, Teddy. Now, let me put it this way. I saw a pillow when I was in Florida not too long ago. You know, pillows with slogans on them? It said, in dog years, I'd be dead. Which I laughed hysterically at myself in front of a store window. In dog years, I would be dead. It's very funny when you think about it. It used to be 7 years. Now, with the medication and the special trick foods, they go on for 20, 21 years. They cost sometimes as much as a person to keep alive towards the end. Vet bills and this bill and that bill. But we all come to take care of these animals and their surrogate children or grandchildren in so many ways. But the animal won't learn to control his peeing. I don't know how to put it. He's good for a few days. Then you wake up and he does it here, does it there in the house. Now, little dogs do this more than the big dog. I had many dogs in my life. My first was Tippy, who bit me in the foot, wrote about it in Psychological Nudity, bit me down to the bone. He was bad to the bone. He was part Chow and totally mad. He had a part purple tongue, and he was crazy. This dog went for my foot when I was 11 like it was a ham hock, and he bit it right down to the bone. I mean, it was really frightening to see your own bone sticking out. And they didn't put him to sleep. My father almost put me to sleep instead. He said, I provoked it to show you what a wonderful upbringing a person could have. But that dog wouldn't pee in the house. I think he was afraid that something would happen to him that was pretty brutal. But the truth is my father taught me how to housebreak a dog, and I did. We all did. He said, you rub the dog's nose in his pee. You do it enough times, and you say, no, don't talk to him. He's not a person. I love how liberals talk to babies. You ever see this? A whole conversation like they're going to make the child smarter. So listen, we're going to go out tonight to your favorite restaurant. What do you think you might have tonight? The kid looks at him like they're crazy. He doesn't know what you're talking about. It's the same with the dog. Use simple terms like no and yes, don't and do. So in any case, the dog, you take the nose and you rub it in real bad. I mean, right into the nostrils, in the nose, down the channel. Do that a few times. I couldn't do that to Teddy because he's too small. So the chow was bigger and tougher. Oh, he got even. But everyone rubbed his nose in it. He took it out on me. But with Teddy, I never had the heart to do that because he was like a little, you know, a little dog. He's a toy poodle. And I never cut his fur. He looks like a bear, a little teddy bear. You know, that's what a poodle looks like if you don't mutilate them the way the French do. They're gorgeous. They look like bears. They're astounding. When I walk with a dog, people say, oh, what kind of dog is that? What kind of dog is that? I say a poodle. Really? Yeah, really. He's just the way they normally are. Blah, 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 blah. So anyway, I don't know what to do with him. I know that you can train him, but I'm afraid if you bring him to a trainer, they do like trick things with electric shocks that they don't show you. You know, there's something, I know they do something, you know, wrong to the dog. So I don't want to bring him over there, but I've been having discussions with him, like, Teddy, we like you, but I'm telling you, if you don't stop this, something bad's going to happen because I can't take it anymore. I just can't do this anymore. You know, you take him to one house and another. I have another house I went to. I found under the bed he did the bedspread and I'm sick of it already.
Savage.
I have so many good callers. Let me jump to them right now. Austin, Texas, Joanne, welcome to the Savage Nation. Topic, please.
Dr. Savage, well, Teddy is my topic. You know what? He is old enough and smart enough to know where to go to the bathroom in the backyard. I think Teddy needs a girlfriend.
Now, how would that stop him from peeing on my couch?
I actually had a poodle boy dog who was fixed, and as he got older, he got worse about that, and I kind of thought it was like marking his territory. So I had some friends who had some poodles, and we just kind of had play days, and it seemed to solve his problem if we did that every few months. He just felt like he was loved.
You mean even though they cut his thing off, he still wanted to do it with a girl?
Well, he'd still do it to a chair of a table, so yeah.
Oh my God. Wow.
Just because
where is he getting his testosterone from if they cut off the schlemagagel?
I don't know, you know, but for some reason, I think they still want to do that.
He must add a hidden store of it somewhere.
Maybe so, and you know, maybe that's just what gives them that little extra.
It could be. I really don't know. Maybe that. I don't know. Where am I going to get I am looking for a 10-pound gray toy poodle to mate him with because I want to have five or six of his little ones running around the house. You know what I mean? He could be the lead dog, but I do want more of them. I want to multiply my problems because I'm so fond of this animal. He's such a show dog. I want more of his little things running around. You know what I mean? I do.
Yeah, you need to have him. You need to have him reproduce some of those wonderful things.
I do. Absolutely. This thing, the genes on this dog, he's a show dog. Thank you for the call. San Diego, John, you're up on the Savage Nation topic, please. John, go ahead, please. John, what's on your mind?
I got a real great idea for you on housebreaking. Very quickly. Get yourself about a 3-foot pole, you know, like a broom pole. Sharpen it at one end, and then take a rag, pick up the dog's poop, take the rag and the stick over to an area of the yard that you want the dog to go in, and I want you to stake down that rag right into the grass and keep it there. Now,
hold on. Let me see if I follow you. He does go in the backyard. He goes there 99% of the time. In other words, he waits for the morning most of the time. When I first get up, he goes, he can't wait, and I let him out. So he does do that. But you're saying this will reinforce it as the right place to go?
Absolutely. Now, you've got to remember this. This is not 99% that I'm telling you. This is 100%. Okay?
Wait, let me say, you take a stick, like a broomstick, you tie a rag to it, and you dip it in his own urine?
Absolutely. Or in his, pick up the poop.
No, he never poops. He never poops in the house. He only lifts the leg. Now, I put the other stick in the other side in the ground. Am I correct, or I put the side with the pee-pee in it in the ground?
That's correct. With the rag on ground level and stake it down and leave it there. Now,
hold on. I want to follow you now. The part of the stick with the rag with his urine goes in the ground.
Goes in the ground and leave it there.
And that you think that he'll know that that's the spot he should go in only?
Yeah, because you're going to take him over there on leash. Don't take him off leash. Take him on leash every single time he has to go outside.
Don't just let him run there? Because he will do it there 99% of the time.
That's why you're having the problem.
Why?
Don't let him run. You have to take him over on leash. And if you do this for one straight week, I promise you, your housebreaking problem is history. But
I agree with you. I'll probably have pneumonia from it, but that's okay. It doesn't matter. It's nice 5 o'clock in the morning in a pair of pajamas to walk into a garden with a dog to pee. I love it. I've been looking forward to this all my life to end up like to wind up being a dog trainer at my age. Well, but it's worth it though, because I don't want one more piece of furniture ruined.
Well, no, but you've got
John, I want to ask you something. Why are big dogs easier to housebreak than little dogs?
Because they're much more intelligent.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh, no, I don't know. This dog is pretty smart. I think of all the animals I've ever had, he's about the smartest I've ever had.
They're much easier to work with. Little dogs have a tendency to have a real...
they're sneaky.
Attitude.
They're sneaky. Isn't it true that they're sneaky? Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. That's
John, I think there's another element to this. I swear to you, I've been thinking about why. And let me run this by you. You're the expert, not me. I think that I've over-babied him because he's so small. I've not treated him more like a dog. I treated him more like something almost like a child. And I think that's why he's turned into this.
Mr. Savage, every dog is an individual, just like you and I, okay?
I know, yes.
The problem that we make ourselves is that we don't treat a dog like a dog. We treat it like a human being. And
I agree.
That causes problems down the road. Okay?
Well, it's like a liberal. The reason liberals urinate on everybody with their mouths is because we treat them like people, not like liberals. I think that if we housebroke the liberals, America might survive, don't you?
Well, sure.
How do you housebreak a liberal who's so psychotic that they could walk around in a blizzard and say it's caused by global warming? Can we tie the snow to their foot?
Well, that might work.
You know, I remember I once said to you, I heard once when I was in high school, so many things I learned in Jamaica High School because they were smart, commonsensical teachers. And a teacher once said, you know how you don't listen to everything? You're sitting there dreaming off, looking at the girl's ponytail, can't wait for spring, whatever. But certain things come in your head that you never, ever leave your mind, never. And one of them was the statement that the difference between a crazy person or a sane and an insane person is not what you think, but what you do. Many people have so-called insane thoughts, but you repress them. You don't act on them. That's the differential between an insane and a sane person. You follow what I'm saying? All of us get bizarre, nutty impulses in our life, sometimes on a regular basis, but we can control them. Crazy people can't control them. The question is, why are so many otherwise sane people becoming insane or deranged? And the answers are many, but the primary answer is Prozac and Prozac-like compounds. So many people are on these drugs, and these drugs are known to have a high incidence of suicidal and homicidal relationships to them. I don't think that the medical establishment wants you to know it, but it's well documented. You keep repressing urges in a person, and what do you think is going to happen? Tell me what's going to keep repressing urges, and eventually those urges are going to find their way out like water coming out of rock. There's only so much you can trick your mind and your body.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
So now, to give you what many of you have been waiting for, I have to do the quick version. I don't want to dwell on it. I got so mad in a restaurant, went to an Indian restaurant, I got sick from it. Not that the food was bad, it was everything was wrong. It didn't taste good, it was overpriced, they brought the wrong dish. I was up all night itching from the spices. I mean, I'm sick of it. Everywhere I go now in a restaurant, something goes wrong. Maybe they're using like inferior, stuff and doctoring it. I don't know. So I'm going to do my own. So I make paella, which is a Spanish rice dish. And it's done 1,000 different ways. What is paella? It's a rice dish cooked with whatever they happen to have after going fishing or on the farm. They threw it into the equivalent of a Spanish wok. And they cooked it together, and that was the end of it. So everyone has their own recipe. My recipe is quite simple. Now, usually you're supposed to use shrimp and clams and mussels. I'm not using shrimp, nor clams, nor mussels, because lately I found most of the shrimp I'm eating is not up to par. I don't like clams and mussels lately. So I'm going to use, I bought the ingredients already today. I have some fresh calamari from Monterey, which I love. I got chicken legs. You know, the chicken, the healthy chick, the hippie chickens. I got the hippie chickens that are raised on good stuff before they're slaughtered. So I got hippie chicken legs, 3 hippie chicken legs, and I had them cut into 3 pieces. I'm only going to use 2 of them because the pot can't hold it. Now what you need to get is chicken stock, and I usually get the organic chicken stock, and I mix that with water. I never use full stock because it comes out too greasy for me. The rice, you want to use arboreal rice. There's no question about it because it's a long grain rice, but arboreal rice is important. The Italians use arboreal rice. It's used throughout the Mediterranean. I'm giving you the background for the ingredients. So you got the chicken, then I got some nice fresh fish, a nice piece of a cod, and I got a nice piece of fillet of sole. Out here we call it something else. You get a red pepper. When I say, bell pepper, slice it up. Seeded now. Make sure the seeds are out of it. Get a lot of garlic. Get some peas and get some pimentos. The most important thing now is to get really good saffron. Without good saffron, you're not making a paella. And there's a lot of fake saffron out there. A lot of people are selling safflower threads, which is not saffron. They got a cheap imitation from Mexico. Saffron's very expensive. All right. Now, here's how you get started here. Cut the chicken, as I say. Make sure it's all cut up in front of you. And you got to get your spices ready, too. Look, there's a lot more involved. I'm going to give you the broad strokes here. Take your chicken. Rub the chicken with oregano, peppercorns, garlic, salt, olive oil, vinegar, and mash it into the chicken. Make sure you rub it into the chicken good, because the chicken is the most difficult part of this to get flavored right. I happen to like tarragon as well. I love tarragon. Heat olive oil in a deep, heavy skillet. Deep, heavy skillet with sides. Now throw the chicken in and brown it lightly over moderate heat. You're browning it. You're not cooking it. Now you can add not everything yet. You could put in the sausages if you want. You want the chorizo, usually, the salt pork, which I don't use. You want to put in some chopped onion as much as you want. You want to put in that green pepper or red pepper and whatever else you want to flavor it with. Now cook it over low heat with the chicken in there, right? You got that going? While you're doing that, get the water boiling. Now, some people just boil water. I mix, if you're using about 2 cups of rice, you want about 3 3/4, a little less than double liquid. So you can mix it half and half, chicken stock and water. Get it boiling. Get it boiling in a pan, with a top on it. Throw in saffron into the boiling water. Here comes the fun part. So now you got the chicken, if you haven't lost me already, in the frying pan where you're browning it, 10 minutes over low heat. Now, take the rice, the 2 cups of rice, it's dry, and throw it into the frying pan with the chicken and the spices, dry now, and stir the rice around for about 5 minutes, so the rice gets pre-cooked into that mixture of the chicken. It's going to look gunky. It's going to look awful. You're going to say, is he crazy? Why is it not boiling? I don't make rice this way. What you're doing is you're flavoring the rice, or the flavor of the chicken and the spice goes into the rice, each granule of rice. After 5 minutes, take your boiling stock or water with the saffron and throw it right into that pot and stir it all around so the moisture gets into everything. Stir it up cook it rapidly with a cover on it, with a little steam. Let the steam out a little bit. Let the cover off a little bit on the side. You got to get the steam out for about 20 minutes. After about 20 minutes, the rice is going to be cooked. At that point, you want to check the rice on the bottom, make sure it's not burning. Most people look for that slightly caramelized rice on the bottom, and that's a good thing. It's very tasty, but you don't want to burn it. At that point, add some peas. You can cook it for 5 more minutes with some green peas. Then you could add, if you want, mussels and clams on the top until the shells open. Then you could put pimentos on the top. And then you've got basically the best arroz paella that I've ever eaten, because I make it myself. And that's a recipe, that's all. And I wanted to work that in because I got so worked up over Lieutenant Behenna's miscarriage of justice and all of the horrors that are going on in the world, from Haiti to the lunatics like Pat Robertson and Danny Glover, that I had to go to a recipe. So forgive me for my sin. Let's go to the callers for a moment. New York City, WOR. What's on your mind today, Renee?
Hi, I just wanted to call to thank you. For a very long time, my son wanted a dog. My husband wanted nothing to do with it. And how he appealed to his senses is by saying to him about how much you love your dog, how you always talk about your dog, how Teddy is a wonderful pet. And it actually worked, and we were able to talk him into a dog.
So now what kind of dog do you have?
We have a Puggle. It's a cross between a pug and a beagle. And it actually, of all the people in my home, I think my husband takes to the dog probably the most. The person who
And it's a little dog, right? It's a little one?
It's a little dog, very lovable. And, you know, everybody...
It seems to bring out in men a kindness that they can't express to their wives and children anymore. I mean, I don't mean to be sarcastic, Renee, but, you know, I've seen a trend in America, which I noted first 3, 4, 5 years ago, of very large men with very small dogs. And I think it's because men are having an increasingly difficult time finding an outlet for their affectionate sides. Women have become hardened and very masculine. I mean, let me lay it on the line. That's what's happened. You know that. Women, once they reentered the workforce, they want to compete with men in work, and they're doing it in every other way, and they're exceeding and succeeding men in many ways. And men are afraid of them. They're intimidated from women by women. Many men, and they don't have anywhere to go with their kindness, I think. And I see a lot of big guys with little dogs.
Well, I've been very lucky. I've always been a stay-at-home mom, so I was really never out in the workforce. So I just think that he...
Well, I got to Renee, you got to understand something. A dog is a big problem. In other words, you got it 24/7 till it dies. You know, they're very cute for a while, and then you get tired of cleaning up and picking up and watching them, and it's a big responsibility. By the way, it's a very good way to teach children what it is to raise a child, is to get them a pet. It's one of the greatest things to do for a young child, is to teach them responsibility. But you've got to make the child take care of that dog, and you've got to say to them, look, that dog is like a child. That dog has to be walked, the dog has to be fed, the dog has to be loved, or it's going to get sick, or it's going to make on the floor. And it teaches the child responsibility. It teaches the child to put off its pleasure impulse in favor of taking care of the animal, and it trains the child to become a better parent someday, I think. I'll be right back.
Savage.
You know, one of my hobbies is boating. And you know what I have in my hand? I'm like a kid in a toy shop now. I used to buy, you know... I bought cups, old Navy cups, from a guy up in Seattle. Like cups and saucers from a captain's ship. Plates. And they're like brand new. I don't know how he got them. Oh, they're beautiful. They're costly. I love the heavy china. I can't wait to have a cup. Do you ever have coffee in a Navy cup? Heavy cups of a certain type? They're not made of melanin, I'll tell you that right now. It says lead-free, but they're not melanin. These were not made in China. These were made for the U.S. Navy when they were still made in America. You know what I mean, before Clinton took power. Before you can't even find a cup anymore in a store not made somewhere else. Heavy, you hear? You hear that? Just the sound of it. I feel like I'm Admiral Rickover holding. No, I can't explain it. Every time I go on my boat, it's cold. I want to have a cup of coffee. It's the first thing I want. Even if I had one at home, now I have a cup finally to do it with. There is something about a cup of coffee on a boat, particularly wet and cold out here. It's horrible. It's like a nightmare. It's like Noah's Ark. It's like 40 days and 40 nights without let-up. I can't stand the weather. The only reason I'm mentioning it, which is a no-no in talk radio, because, you know, like, it's national, and you shouldn't tell them what your local, what time is, or weather, because there's so many zones and weather. Because I'll tell you why. Although San Francisco is backwards in every other way, socially, we're just the anus of the empire out here in terms of social disorder. But in so many other ways, what happens here first will hit you next. So get ready for the storms that are coming. How do you like it? I did remember it was like this once before, but I've lived in the islands, in Samoa once, and in you ever read the book Rain by Somerset Maugham? Well, I lived through Rain by Somerset Maugham. When the children were very young and I was collecting plants in Fiji, we were in a little house in Suva with a tin roof. You cannot believe what it's like to live under a rainstorm in the tropics that doesn't let up for 20 or 30 days in a row. It can really get on your nerves. It can really make you want to listen to Jim Morrison and take him literally. You know, I'm telling you, there's just nowhere to go with it. Play Jim Morrison for a minute on the Savage Nation.
You know, the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide. Break on through to the other side. Break on.
That message goes out to the holder of a Cal College degree on MSNBC. It's time to listen to Jim Morrison. We realize that the DDT and other toxic chemicals, probably TBC, did hurt you neurologically. There's no question. That's where the tremors come from. And the bizarre statements that you make on television. It's only a matter of time until Daddy GE dumps you. Very soon, Daddy GE is going to just send you a... You're going to come to work one day, sir, and they're not going to let you in the building. There's going to be a cardboard box waiting for you outside of the MSNBC building. In it, you will find the remnants of your once... a glorious past. All of it will be behind you. And then, of course, you'll try talk radio, but Air America's gone. So what's left for you? That's why I say, sir, it's time to listen to Jim Morrison and take him literally. I'm having too much fun, and I keep admitting it. On MichaelSavage.com, you can see all the important stories. And you can keep contributing to Lieutenant Behenna, or please send the poor guy a letter. That's the least you can do. I'm thinking of organizing a group to go down and visit him. You know what I'm saying? We owe it to our heroes. All of us do. There's a story of... this is what they glorify. Adult film star Juliet Ann Peg Anderson dies at age 71. Juliet Ann Peg Anderson took the artsy aspect to new levels. They glorify her, in other words. From the time she entered the adult film industry, I love that phrase to begin with, in 1978 at the then unheard of age of 39, until she died January 10th of a heart attack at 71 at her home in where else but Berkeley, she tried to transform the seamy into acceptable sensuality for older people. She was the original cougar, they said. In other words, they glorified. Wait, it gets even better. Now, this is from the local newspaper. In addition to her 80 hardcore porn films, so in other words, she's equal to, let us say, Tolstoy, Shakespeare. They're comparing her porn films, in other words, to the output, let's say, of a prolific author or a scientist, let's say, who published 70 or 80 groundbreaking papers in neurology or neuroscience. But in San Francisco, that she's in 80 hardcore porn films is actually better. She also worked as a relationship counselor. She lectured on sensuality and contributed essays to books such as The Sexual Healers, Women of the Light. In 1991, she developed and marketed a form of erotic massage. Then they end with, a public memorial will be held for the porn star at the Center for Sex and Culture in San Francisco. As I say to you, that's why I love the city. This is the city that keeps on giving. There's not a day that goes by that I'm not impressed with the insanity of the city. I am. I got to tell you that. That's why I love it so much. Combined with the beauty and a bum puking into a mailbox, there's nothing better. Ruth in New York on WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael.
Now, where else can you get a city as beautiful as this where you can see a bum puking or defecating in a mailbox? And if you go up to him and you say anything, the cops arrest you. How much better can it get than that?
Oh,
you know why? Because it's his lifestyle choice to defecate in a mailbox. You understand, Ruth?
Oh.
According to San Francisco's ethos, a bum has the right to defecate in a mailbox. That's his lifestyle choice.
Well, I live in a little more sane area, an hour and a half away from New York City, in a town in Connecticut called Trumbull.
Trumbull, Connecticut?
Trumbull, not Trouble. T-R-U-M, oh. Like in Michael. B-U-L-L.
Isn't everybody in Connecticut troubled? Everybody in Connecticut's a troubled New Yorker, I think.
Well, I've been out long enough not to be too troubled to be out of it.
Well, you live in the land of Obama.
Not for me, and not for many of us.
All right, so Lieberman is from Connecticut. He struck a middle ground. So what are you calling about today from Connecticut on OR in New York?
I am calling to quote you George Orwell's quote about some are more equal than others.
And that refers, of course, to Madam Pelosi, where some animals are more equal than others in Animal Farm after the revolution, correct?
Philosophy. You know, Michael, I couldn't even look at the speech at the because...
Did you hear... Oh, you mean Obama's so-called speech?
But you know what? I couldn't...
Have you seen the video of him bowing to the mayor of Tampa, Florida, a woman? Have you seen that? The man actually bows from the waist as he gets Air Force One. Now, what is the bowing with Obama? I could see why he bows down to the King of Saudi Arabia. After all, the man gave him a gold necklace. I could see why he bowed down to China. They hold our notes. But why does he bow down to the mayor of Tampa, Florida? Does anyone know why?
Michael, I'm...
I know there were sponge divers there, but I don't understand what sponges have to do with Obama. Is there some relationship there that I can't put together?
I know
Santo Traficante began in Tampa, and I don't think that has anything to do with the mayorship. Do you?
No. But what I do want to...
I watch too much television. You have to forgive me. Let's have a little rock and roll for the minute on the Savage Nation. I don't want to bum people out, you know. I'd like to talk about some nice things. This is astounding. A group called the National Sleep Foundation, the NSF, probably a front for a mattress group for all I know, says that each ethnic group sleeps differently. Most African Americans like to pray just before they sleep it. White Americans like to do it with their pets, and Asians tend to do it best, meaning sleep. So whites sleep with dogs and cats. Asians sleep better than anybody else, according to these people. And it says African Americans like to pray just before they go to sleep. The NSF surveyed 1,007 adults aged 25 to 60 for the annual poll. I never sleep well. I never have a good night's sleep, so where do I fit in? Who said sleep is important? See, you got to understand how much of this is fear. All your life you've been told, eat this and you'll die. Ingest that and you'll die. The water you drink is poisoned by bottled water. The air you breathe is poisonous to kill you and your children and ruin your gonads. Now they're telling you that if you don't sleep, you're going to drop dead. So again, what is it all telling you? Go to either Big Daddy government, Obama's going to make your food cleaner, your air cleaner, your water cleaner, and you're going to sleep better if you vote for Obama. I actually believe I'm a contrarian when it comes to sleep. I mean, it's good if you can get it. But I've come to understand you don't really need sleep. Not much of it anyway. We need much less sleep than we think we need. Look at what men can do in combat when they have to. Look at what people have to do when they hold down three jobs when they really have to. Look what you did when you were into sex, drugs, and rock and roll, how little sleep you can get away with them compared to now. You really think you need 9 hours in a bed? What for? I mean, if I lay down and sleep, I know it's coming. It's either going to be me as an ancient Mayan with my face painted with various dyes, cutting someone's heart out and rolling them down a pyramid, usually my business enemies, or it's me at Heathrow Airport trapped and I can't get home. I don't know which is worse. Me as an ancient Mayan cutting out someone's heart. No, I'm joking. I never had that dream. Or the repetitive dream of me being trapped at Heathrow. I don't really understand that. It's symbolic because I'm trapped at Heathrow, in essence, because I'm banned in Britain. I'm Michael Savage. Be here.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Now listen!
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You're listening to the Savage Nation. I'm the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill. Just give me a minute, please. Listen to this. From a dead white male. Imagine what we have now, whiny chick music and crack music, wherever you turn. Listen to the end of this. Listen to how this mind worked. It brings me to tears to think that there were minds on the planet like this. Listen to how he builds this. Listen to the mind. Okay? Just let yourself go. Go with it. Okay, here we go. Probably heard this, but you didn't know who it was. Higher, 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 higher. Higher. But you can't stand it anymore. So, we have gone from the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill. This is the Savage Nation talking about all of those things. You know, you listen to Rossini's Barber of Seville. I heard it the other day in a car. I said, I got to play it for a minute, take a chance. Look how fast this man's mind could be. Listen how fast it was. Pre-drug mind. And you have musicians today, so-called musicians. They're basically barbarians faking it as musicians. Everything is ersatz, the painting, the music, you name it. A collapsed, broken society with false idols everywhere you turn, whether they're false preachers or false musicians. Whatever, false scientists, whatever you want to do, wherever you turn, ersatz, you know what I'm saying? Mayonnaise, not butter, whichever way you want to look at it. Margarine, not butter, whichever way you want to look at it. Olive-like, not olive, you know. And you ask yourself, how did this happen? How did the people become so denatured? And it's mystifying, actually, to think. It doesn't happen overnight. So if you think you're going to turn it around overnight, you're mistaken. When a thing like this happens to a society, it doesn't turn around overnight just because you know it, or because a million of us know it, or 10 million of us know it, or 30 million of us know it. You got to remember, it's a world of 5 billion people, most of whom live in the darkness of getting and spending. The darkness of getting and spending. The darkness of buying and selling. The darkness of entertaining themselves and shopping. The darkness of looking at sluts in Hollywood as the role models, not Martha Washington. The darkness of looking at fakers in Hollywood who are pretending to be heroes when the real heroes of the world are never seen nor heard, whether they be in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in a hospital room or at a ward for crippled children. You never see these people. And so we live in the darkness. That in some ways, it's worse than the darkness in the Middle Ages. In some ways, although we are certainly better off physically than our ancestors were, although that's debatable unto itself, would you say that we live in the light, living in a society that we live in today? You know, you look at men in the suburbs, the white suburbs. You say, oh, that's the lily white suburbs. It's all good there. And I see men with children and wives. They're probably decent people. They dress like boys. I just look and I don't understand it.
How can a grown man walk around with shorts, I ask myself, and a hat on backwards pushing a stroller? Does he look at himself in the mirror? I mean, I'm not the sartorial expert of the world, but there's something in that image that I feel as though like from another planet sometimes. A grown man pushing a carriage wearing shorts and a hat on backwards trying to look like an 11-year-old boy. How does this happen? The father looks like Beavis and Butthead. Anyway, from the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill was the little quip. Now we're going to play the Brandenburg Concerto by Johann Sebastian Bach. And think how we've fallen from the Brandenburg Concerto to crack music and whiny chick music in department stores in just so short a period of time. And you're telling me the dead white male has nothing to teach you? I would argue to the contrary. Let's hear a little bit of the Brandenburg Concerto so you know what greatness is. Does the mind still hear this? Does the American mind still hear any? I don't know anymore. Am I allowed to come out from behind the curtain? Can I come out from behind the image? Am I allowed to show this side of myself to you, the people, the listeners, the wonderful listeners of the Savage Nation who have given me so much love, respect? Dare I play a thing like this and tell you how it breaks my heart to play it? To think that we live in a debased society where goons from the gutters are held up as role models for your children to look at. Goons from the gutters held up as musicians when they are nothing. They're not musicians. Goons from the gutters held up as artists by con men in the record companies and the movie companies. Goons from the gutters held up as role models, and you wonder why every minute they pull out a gun and shoot each other. You wonder why boys pull out a gun and shoot each other at a moment's notice because goons from the gutters are held up as role models. You're taking your son to a concert to hear the Brandenburg Concerto? Of course not. That's not a concert. A concert is a bunch of drugged, stoned out sex maniacs throwing themselves around on the ground. That's a concert today. Yeah, all right, say it's just the rantings of an old man. What do I care what you say? You know, I'm as much a hedonist as the next man. I can enjoy myself as much as you can. I can guarantee you. I know how to enjoy myself. I know how to have a drink. I know how to have a good time, believe me. But that doesn't mean I have to roll in the mud with the pigs in order to have a good time. And it means that I can tell you when the pigs are rolling in the mud of your mind, if you don't mind. And that's all I'm going to say on the matter. Just play it for a minute, and I'll come back to my reality here of politics as usual on the Savage Nation. Politics as usual, the barbarians on the hill running our lives. Big Sis in charge of Homeland Security, stripping the braces off a four-year-old boy. Big Sis in charge of Homeland Security. Defense Secretary Robert Gates saying, I'm not going to go there when the word Muslim came up. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying he's worried about the consequences of an attack on Iran, not knowing which side they're playing for. You don't know which side of the... What team are they playing for? You don't know it. We don't know it. There's nothing clear for us anymore. The government is confusing us by telling us that they don't know what to do except to control us, not the enemy. Yeah, bring in more Muslims so they can become cab drivers and deny... Don't you understand what's happening to your country right in front of your eyes? Because you let liberalism, the mental disorder, take over the nation? That is why we're losing it all. It's a philosophy, Jake. It all starts with a philosophy. As so many times have I quoted Blake, the great 19th century poet, who said, the eye that alters, alters all. Don't you remember that quote? And I'm trying to say it to you because I'm not trying to prove how smart I am. Listen to what Blake was saying. The eye that alters, alters all. Once the eye is altered, meaning if you're a little nuts, everything is altered. And so we have a government now with altered eyes that have altered all. That's what he was trying to say. They may as well all be on LSD for how they're treating the people of this country.
They may as well all be stoned out of their minds on some kind of drug, which is not to say they are, but they may as well be, because their altered eye is altered all. That's what we, the people, are trying to say to them. The people know more about their lives than the government does. The people know more about a balanced budget than the government does. The people know more about not taking in any more immigrants than the government does. The people know more about these things than career bureaucrats who have never created a product or a service that anybody ever wanted. Because if they did, they would be on a welfare line themselves. They would never have produced the product anybody wanted, and that's why they're in government. And so they continue to produce services nobody wants with your money. And now you wonder why people are angry, why there's a rebellion in this country. You can call it a right-wing rebellion if you want to target the right. I don't care. Say what you want. I'm proud to say it's a rebellion on the right, but believe me, it's a rebellion from the middle. That's the one thing the New York Times didn't get right in that article, amongst others. Tea Party lights fuse for rebellion on right. It's not a rebellion on the right. It's a rebellion from the center. This is a rebellion of the middle class. This is a rebellion of Joe and Sarah. This is a rebellion of people who have worked hard all their lives, and they've lost their jobs, they've lost their houses, and they don't know why. And they see fat cats on Wall Street getting bailed out by Obama, who talks the talk but doesn't walk the walk. A man who says he's for the little people and supports the big people who put him in office. A man who says he's the taking on the banks when, in fact, it's the banks who took him and put him into the presidency. It's a man who says he's for balancing the budget when he breaks the budget. It's a man who deals with the biggest money trader on planet Earth, who could break the dollar overnight and then say, whoops, I don't know how that happened, even though I just had dinner with him, because he visited the White House 35 times, according to the White House logs. So we're not so stupid. It's the age of the internet. Most people know what's going on. It's not 1950. You know, suddenly it's not 1967 either. And that's all I want to say about that.
Savage.
When I was a little boy in the United States of America, the son of immigrants, my mother would proudly tell me that the difference between America and Europe at that time was that we had a giant middle class. A spectrum, of course, of people in the middle class, from lower, middle, and upper middle class. But nevertheless, there was a gigantic middle class in America that distinguished this nation from Europe after World War II. I don't have to take you back into ancient history to know that at one time there were serfs and landowners, the princes and the serfs. That was all ended somewhere in the middle 1500s, I believe, when people were permitted to own their own land. And that was the end of the serfdom. That was a great step forward for humankind when people could own their own piece of land. So we have, through America, seen the growth of a tremendous middle class where most people own their own properties, their own houses, their own apartments, their own condos, whatever. That's a good thing. That's what makes us unique and great, different from any other society on earth. Until very recently, when something changed, a dramatic shift occurred in this bell curve. The rich, the middle, and the poor. The bell curve, looking at it as though it's strictly a bell, with a big middle, big fat middle, big bell, big fat middle bell, big fat middle on the bell, middle class, suddenly that shrunk. It shrunk. Honey, I shrunk the kids. And the big middle started to disappear, diminish. Millions of people lost their jobs, lost their houses, lost their families. That's what this so-called revolution is going on, that's going on in this country. That's where it's coming from. So now let me ask you something. Certainly Obama didn't start this. Bush did. But I called Bush a fiscal socialist, as I tell you, over 2 years ago. I was on to that fact that the Republicans were all part of the same conspiracy, albeit in a different track. I know about the Bilderbergs. I know about all of that stuff. But at the risk of your displeasure, those of you on the right, I'm not going to go into the Bilderbergs. I'm not going to go into the CFR. I'm fully aware of their interconnections to the banks on Wall Street and the governments that we have in the Senate and the Federal Reserve. Believe me, I could talk chapter and verse, but I choose not to at this time. I want to stick to the bell curve. So America was distinguished by the big, big middle. Are you bored yet? If you are, I can move on. We can talk about lingerie in Saudi Arabia. I mean, whatever you want to do, I'll go with you. I hear that they're banning lingerie in Saudi Arabia. Take a look at the women over there. You know why. I don't know. Wonder the women don't want lingerie in Saudi Arabia. Most of the men are in Paris picking. Okay, let's stop right there. But I don't want to get distracted.
Okay, so the middle class starts to disappear, and there's actually a growth curve in the rich. There's a growth curve in the rich and a growth curve in the poor, and the middle class is shrinking. So we're becoming a two-class society. We're moving towards becoming a two-class society rather than a three-class society. You see what I'm getting at? And where did we last see the two-class society? Well, many places, but most typically in the Marxist socialist states, where there is clearly a two-class society. What you don't know is that these workers' paradises have a two-class society. You have the bureaucrats who work for the government, who live fairly well. They get the food. They have the dachas. They had the private houses out in the country. They had government cars and chauffeurs. And the other people lived on fighting for the one salami hanging in the butcher shop that I keep talking about, because the agrarian revolution didn't work when it was run by the government. Now, of course, that's all changed. I recognize that. The Soviet Union is a hybrid in some ways. They have very little, in many ways, social freedoms are very diminished. But economically, they're in some ways more conservative, fiscally more conservative than we are. It's hard to believe, isn't it? But the Soviet Union is probably more fiscally conservative than the United States of America is right now. But it goes back to what I told you years ago in The Savage Nation. I was a big reader as a youngster, and one of the people I read everything he wrote was Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, you know about it. Huxley wrote in 1950 that in the future, he said, as the Soviet becomes more like, in 1950 he wrote that as America and the Soviet Union interact, the Soviet Union would become more like America, and America would become more like the Soviet Union. Enter stage left, Barack Obama.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Germany, 1967. The children of the Nazi generation have grown up in the ruin their parents created. They vowed fascism would never rule their country again. In their fight for freedom, they lost themselves in the cause.
Da sind mehr von uns drin als draußen.
And ignited a revolution around the world. The Bader-Meinhof Complex, based on the true story of the Red Army faction.
Come on, pigs of Western civilization. Eat more grease. Eat more marbled sirloin, more pork and gravy. Lard up the dressing. Fried chicken in boiling oil. Carry it dribbling to gray climes, snowed with salt. Little lambs covered with mint, roast in racks, surrounded by roast potatoes wet with butter sauce. Buttered veal medallions in creamy saliva. Buttered beef by glistening mountains of French fries. Right. Stroganoffs in white hot sour cream. Chops soaked in olive oil. Surrounded by olives. Salty feta cheese. Followed by Roquefort Blue and Stilton. Thirsty for wine, beer, Coca-Cola, Fanta, champagne, Pepsi, Retsina, Arak, whiskey, vodka. Ah!
You know the day destroys the night. Night divides the day.
I don't know how one old hippie listening to this show can't be having a great time. Welcome back to the Savage Nation, all you old hippies. All you young hippies. All you future hippies. All you non-hippies. All you ex-hippies. And all you Obama hippies. Welcome to the Savage Nation. So here I am, trying to show you the connection between Obama and the Marcuse school of quiet socialism that has gone on in this country, and how he is, let us hope, the last in a long line of those who have gone into the administration, into the system to corrupt it and overturn it and turn it into a socialist system. He was not the first, but let's hope that Obama, being so radical and so immature and trying to push through so much so fast, has awakened the sleeping giant of America. All the men who packed the silos with corn finally have awakened to what has happened to their country. All of the men who raise pigs and cows and wheats and soy. All of the men and women who drive the tractors and drive the trucks. All the men who ride jackhammers and work on the high rises, the low rises, ride the low riders, the high riders. In other words, all of America finally waking up to the fact that we're all about to descend into slavery in this country, all under the hands of this guy pretending to be Robin Hood when he's nothing but a shill for the New World Order socialists who have virtually taken over all avenues of this government, in my opinion. Of course, it's only one man's opinion, And I recognize that many of you will not accept what I am saying. You'll say, come on, get off it. Don't exaggerate. Don't be a drama queen. He's just trying to take away some of the excess in the medical system and make it more fair. Well, that's one way to look at it, except when you really look at it, which you haven't done, and I did, because I do it for a living. I looked at it. The premiums go up. The care goes down. The government decides whether you live or die. There is no reining in the greedy, disgusting, verminous tort lawyers. There's no limitation on health care for the illegal alien parasites who have invaded America and don't deserve anything for free, but they're going to get it. So don't tell me this is about fairness. This is about a ripoff, to use a 60s phrase. But I don't want to get too excited. I just want to have a good time. Because boys just want to have a good time, and I'm just going to have a good time. And so I want to go back to Freud's idea of pansexualism, because if I say sex, I'm going to get your attention even more than I already have it. And so one of the main ideas of the Frankfurt School of socialism under Herbert Marcuse, the grandfather, the philosophical grandfather of Obama, was to exploit Freud's idea of pansexualism, which I try to tell you a little bit about, you know, attack the authority of the father. Search for pleasure at all costs. Always tell the people that they deserve pleasure, should have pleasure, must have pleasure, will have pleasure. Don't deny pleasure. Pleasure is the reason you're not feeling good. Your doctor says have pleasure. How come you're not having pleasure? Why don't you have pleasure? Why are you denying pleasure? Have pleasure. Do pleasure. Do it in the road. Wherever it feels good, do it. Have it in the road. Do it in the road. Sex is good for you. Have pleasure. Do pleasure. Be pleasure. You are pleasure. You are only the pleasure principle. You're all id. You're no ego. You're no superego. You're nothing but a walking id. You're nothing but a walking id. You're nothing but a walking id. Have pleasure. Have pleasure. Have pleasure, have pleasure. Porn here, porn there. Here's porn, there's porn. Eat candy, do candy, here's drugs. Here's porn, there's porn. Everywhere, porn, porn. Once there were Gideon Bibles, now there's porn even in Marriott hotels. Here's the porn, have some pleasure. It's good for you. Destroys the marriage, destroys the family, destroys the kids. All part of the socialist objective. Have some porn, here's some porn. Want some porn? Want some porn? Here's some porn. Turn the porn on. Corporate accounts, turn the porn on. The school believed there were two types of revolution, A, political, and B, cultural. Cultural revolution demolishes a society from within. Does that sound like something that you understand? Family, education, media, sex, popular culture. Has there been a revolution or hasn't there been? Well, that's what we're talking about. That's why a guy like me, a guy who went through the 60s and was kind of like, wait a minute, where are we going with this? Who's behind this? Who lived through the whole peace and love bull crap of the 1960s and saw the guys with the peace signs in their hands who were the drug dealers, the guys who try to rip off your old lady, the guys who try to break into your house when you turned your back. Oh, but they had the long hair and they had the hippie glasses. I wasn't conned for 1 minute. I was never taken in by it. Let's all share, man, as long as it was your stuff they were sharing. I know the whole game. Believe me, I know where they're coming from. Nobody hates hippie pigs more than I do. So don't think you're fooling me or you Berkeleyite phony. Okay, I'll stop right there. So there was a political and a cultural revolution. And what does that mean today? What it means today is that the witch hunt that you are seeing on today's campuses, the witch hunt you are seeing, for example, going on against Michael Savage wherever you turn, the blacklisting of Michael Savage in Britain, the blacklisting by certain advertising agency, the fear amongst certain people about Michael Savage, all unfounded because I'm actually the true patriot. I'm actually representative of America. They've tried to demonize me, and they've done so with many people because they control the media. So the witch hunts that are going on today in the media on the campuses is the implementation of Marcuse's concept of repressive toleration. Write this one down. What is repressive toleration? It is the tolerance for movements from the left, but intolerance for movements from the right. And that is exactly what we're living through on the universities in the media. Tolerance for movements from the left, but intolerance for movements from the right. So they tolerate vermin at MSNBC who are talentless left-wing Obamaite hacks, and they demonize a guy like Michael Savage, who is revered and loved by millions of people who have a brain and are not drug-addled. I take you back in time to the Biedermannhof gang in Germany in the 70s. You don't have to actually know who Bieder was or who Meinhof was to understand what I'm about to tell you. I'll just tell you in short, the Biedermannhof gang was a radical left-wing group of machine gunners and bombers who attacked the middle class, kidnapped, all in the name of peace, justice, and love. Now, they supported the Arab cause. They hated Jews in Israel. They claimed they hated Zionism. not Jews, but of course they hated Jews and Zionism, being the grandchildren or the children of Nazis. They really didn't fall far from the tree. Although they posed as leftists who are out for social justice and in favor of the Third World and the Third World Liberation theology, by the way, which Obama was fed for 20 straight years at his church, in his colleges, etc., liberation theology. You heard all of that, Third World Liberation theology. It's exactly what Obama was bred and schooled in. And the Obama-Biden-Monhoff connection is what I want to talk about today. So that when we talk about the health care bill, which is going to come up over and over again, you have to understand how this connects to the radicals going back to the Biden-Monhoff gang, who were influenced by the writings of Mao Zedong and the philosophers associated with what is called the Frankfurt School, and Marxist philosophers such as Herbert Marcuse. Now, many of you have heard of Saul Alinsky and Bill Ayers, but you may not have heard of Herbert Marcuse. Herbert Marcuse was the founder of the Frankfurt School of Marxist theory. And one of the main ideas of the Frankfurt School was that instead of outright revolution and social disruption, the left would allow society to continue providing goods and services and to defend the nation, while they, the left-wing intellectuals, would take charge of education, manipulate the public with media propaganda, corrupt morality through the entertainment industry, and infiltrate government bureaucracy at all levels. Does it sound familiar? This is exactly what Barack Obama has succeeded in doing. He's not the first, but he certainly should be the last in this long line of Marxist revolutionaries who have been in the White House. I would say Bill Clinton was the first. We also know that Obama's childhood mentor, Frank Marshall Davis, was a member of the Communist Party. We know that Obama admits attending, quote, socialist conferences. We know that Obama admits reading Marxist literature. We know that Obama became a community organizer and came into contact with the Democratic Socialists of America, who then endorsed his campaign for Illinois State Senate. And we know that Obama became friends with William Ayers, a member of the socialist group Students for a Democratic Society, which was a violent group, by the way. And yet now, Obama has infiltrated government bureaucracy to the highest level of all. The Biden-Monhoff gang used violence to try to achieve socialism, and they failed. They were defeated. But Obama was more faithful to Herbert Marcuse and his plan to infiltrate government peacefully. And he has succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. And so that is why I want to talk about Obama and the reverse Robin Hood myth and the health care proposal and the Maoists, Marxists, and other communists known as czars in the administration and what you can do about it.
Savage.
Savage University of Higher Learning. So we're going beyond the day-to-day because it's of interest. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? See, if you focus, okay, Obama's pushing to give to the poor and he's just a nice guy trying to help those who don't have and take from the pigs on the top. That's one scenario, but it's all false because, as I pointed out, is there one poor person listening to this show who's benefited at all from Obama? I don't think so. There are none. He's actually trying to steal from the middle class to give to the rich, to the cronies who put him in power. It came out that Obama's called for increasing payroll taxes on households earning less than $250,000. And that's an apparent breach of his oft-repeated pledge. He will also increase taxes on interest, dividends, annuities, royalties, and rents, all aimed at those making less than $250,000. So he violated another one of his primary campaign goals, that he was not targeting the middle class, which he is. But you say, well, okay, we understand that, and that's good. But I want to take it back so you know where we're going. See, if you don't know where he's coming from, and you just, like, get shocked every day by another slap from Obama and his Marxist minions, you're not going to know where they want to take you. This is a revolution that's going on in America, and it's not good for anybody. The revolution ends badly for everybody. And so, as I say to you, this is a quiet cultural revolution, not one of violence, although you could argue that Instead of unleashing the Biedermannhof gang with bombs in the streets, he's unleashed the military on Afghanistan. I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but one could make that analogy. What's interesting to me about the war in Afghanistan is this. Where are the street protests? How come there was such a huge outcry against the Iraq war from the radical phony leftists, and there's hardly a peep out of them now? The answer is because they were never against the war in Iraq. They're only against Republicans and Bush. And because now that the Democrats are running the war, the bombs have D's on them, and therefore the bombs are good bombs. Any bomb with a D on it is a good bomb. Any bomb with a D, any bullet with a D on it is a good bullet. It doesn't really matter to them. They were never against the war. They were against Republicans and Bush. And so, again, they were just trying to undermine the Republican administration, which they did do. They undermined the war on terror, which is why we now have a civil trial for one of the worst mass murderers in history, a man who masterminded, on our soil, rather, he masterminded the 9/11 attacks, and yet they have sympathy for him, while Lieutenant Behenna has absolutely no support, and he's rotting in Fort Leavenworth. It's interesting to me that many of my listeners were self-identified liberals of the 60s, and they don't really know what their identity is today. They're not really a leftist or a progressive because they know that most of them are phonies, and it's all hot air rhetoric that's used to grift people out of things. But they're not willing to say they're a conservative, and I don't blame them because when you see the fake conservatives out there, I know they don't want to identify with that. So they call themselves an independent or a moderate, which is probably more close to the truth than it is. But many of my listeners who call themselves moderate or libertarians or independents are actually liberals. They're actually true liberals. What you don't understand is that the whole definition of what a liberal is has changed. So let's not worry so much about definitions. Let's worry instead or focus instead on what a hardcore Maoist, Marxist, socialist is and what he wants to do to the United States of America and what he is actually doing under the guise of helping people get health care right now. And so you have to go back to Herbert Marcuse and the Frankfurt School, okay? And so the Frankfurt School was a conspiracy to take over a country through a quiet cultural revolution, not through violence as was done by the Biedermannhof gang and the other members of the Red Brigade. And I want to talk about this again over and over again today because it's so important for you to know the danger you're actually in. Give me some hard hippie music of the 60s.
Constitution, well, we all want to change your head. You tell me it's the institution.
Okay, so you get the picture. So even the Beatles were singing songs about revolution, encouraging the youth to drop the mores of the middle class, to overthrow their parents' strictures, to tell everyone that they were free and liberated and they were going to, you know, bring about a new order, a new society. And what they don't understand is they actually have brought about a new order and a new society. And who's sitting here listening to the show could say it's a better order and a better society than the one that your parents had? I'd like to know anyone listening to the show tells me you're living in a safer world, a cleaner world, a more moral world, because it just is not true. So I want to go back to what I said before. All of this stems back to the Frankfurt School. We talked about that. We talked about the new left guru of the 60s, Herbert Marcuse. And now I want to advance what they built their Frankfurt School of Socialism upon, which was Freud's idea of pansexualism, the search for pleasure. The search for pleasure became one of the operational methodologies to break people's social mores down, because if they broke you down morally, they could break you down every other way, and they could remold you in the form of the new man that the socialists have always talked about. And so they continue to teach you to search for pleasure. To do this, they exploited the differences between the sexes. They try to overthrow the traditional relationships between men and women. And to further their aims, we read, here's what they were going to do. Attack the authority of the father. Deny the specific roles of father and mother. Take away from families their rights as primary educators of their children. Abolish the differences in the education of boys and girls. Abolish all forms of male dominance, such as the presence of women in the armed forces. And by the way, we read that this dingbat defense secretary is now pushing the submarine fleet to put women on submarines. They're going to have to accommodate women by rebuilding the submarines to accommodate women. But here we are. Got excited, found a Sauvignon Blanc I could drink. Lorenzo makes one. I didn't get a headache. I mean, that to me is a miracle. I can drink wine again. I feel liberated. I said, Lorenzo, do you use malolactic fermentation? No, I don't use a... No malolactic fermentation. I said, good. Thank God. No headache-o. No malolactico, no headache-o. That's all I know. Because I gave up on the New Zealand wines. They became too fruity. I don't know, it was with the lemon-lime. I felt like I was drinking 7-Up. Years ago when I used to drink wine, I'm slipping into the food now. Okay, I do it. I can't find a good white wine anymore. 20 years ago, I used to drink, if I was lucky, I went to someone's house, they had a Grand Cru Chablis. We drank a lot of French Chablis when it was really good. Then there was the Grand Cru Chablis, which a professor friend had. I never heard anything like it. Then there was Batard Chasson. It was unbelievable, white wines then. Then all of a sudden, something happened with white wine. They became, I don't know what they did to them, creamy, fruity. Sorry to tell you, a lot of the children who grew up drinking soda started drinking wine. They didn't like the actual taste of wine. They wanted a soda with alcohol. So it's hard to find, you know. There's no such thing. And New Zealand used to make a great, when it was the Marlboro New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, it was a different story with a slight tinge of the limey in it, you know. Even though the limey's made it, it was a slight tinge of limey. Then all of a sudden now it's like soda. It's like lemon limey. It's like drinking on a machine in a it's like going for lemon limey in a Lois Pitkin. You are listening to the Savage Nation, the one and only Savage Nation.
Savage.